lives conform to the unreality of the myth. Mrs. A subjugates herself to her husband out of a feeling of guilt. "I didn't really love my husband when we married," she says. "I tricked him into it, so I have no right to complain." Mr. B laments, "I regret I didn't marry Miss C, but I didn't fall head over heels in love, so I assumed she couldn't be right." Mrs. D, severely depressed, enters therapy stating, "I don't know what's wrong. I've got a perfect marriage." Only months later can she accept the fact that she has fallen out of love with her husband, but that this does not mean that she has made a horrible mistake. Mr. and Mrs. E acknowledge that they have fallen out of love and then make each other miserable by mutual rampant infidelity as they each search for true love, neither of them realizing that this acknowledgement could mark the beginning of the work of their marriage instead of its end. Even when couples who are no longer romantically in love choose to remain committed, they cling to the myth. "If we act as if we are still in love," their thinking goes, "maybe romantic love will return." In couples group therapy, these couples sit together, speak for each other, defend each other's faults, believing that unity is a sign of the relative health of their marriage. We must tell most couples that they need psychological distance from each other before they can work constructively on their problems. Sometimes we must direct them to sit apart in the group circle. Over and over again we must say, "Let Mary speak for herself, John," and "John can defend himself, Mary, he's strong enough." A true acceptance of your own and your partner's individuality is the only foundation for real love and a mature marriage. Having proclaimed that falling in love is in no way real love, let me point out that falling in love is in fact very close to real love. The misconception is potent because it contains a grain of truth. Real love also has to do with ego boundaries, since it involves extension of one's limits. When we extend our limits through love, we reach out toward the beloved, whose growth we wish to nurture. Before we can do this, we must be attracted toward, invested in, and committed to an object beyond the self. Psychiatrists call this process cathexis. We cathect the beloved object. But when we cathect an object outside ourselves, we also incorporate a representation of that object into ourselves. For example, a man who gardens for a hobby loves gardening. This man has cathected his garden. He finds it attractive. He has invested himself in it. He is committed to it. In the process of cathexis, he comes to know much about gardening and about his particular garden, the types of flowers and plants in it, its problems, its future. The garden exists outside of him, yet through cathexis it also exists within him. It is part of his identity. By loving it, he has incorporated the garden and enlarged his self. What transpires in loving is a gradual enlargement of the self, an incorporation within of the world without, and a stretching and thinning of our ego boundaries. The more we extend ourselves, the more we love, the more blurred becomes the distinction between the self and the world. We become identified with the world and experience the same ecstasy we have when our ego boundaries partially collapse and we fall in love. Only instead of having merged temporarily and unrealistically with a single beloved object, we have merged realistically and more permanently in a mystical union with much of the world. The feeling of ecstasy associated with this union, while less dramatic than the bliss of falling in love, is much more lasting and ultimately satisfying. The heights are not suddenly glimpsed and lost again. They are attained forever. Sexual activity and love, while they may occur simultaneously, are basically separate phenomena. in itself, making love is not an act of love. Nonetheless, sexual intercourse, and particularly orgasm, even in masturbation, is associated with a collapse of ego boundaries and with ecstasy. At the moment of climax, we may shout, "I love you," to a prostitute for whom, after the ego boundaries have snapped back into place, we may feel no shred of affection. The ecstasy of orgasm can be heightened by sharing it with one who is loved. But even without a beloved partner, or any partner, for a second we may forget who we are, be transported outside of ourselves. We may become one with the universe, but only for a second. To describe the prolonged oneness with the universe associated with real love, I use the words mystical union. Mysticism is essentially a belief that reality is oneness. Mystics believe that our common perception of the universe as containing multitudes of separate objects is an illusion. Mystics hold that true reality can be known only by experiencing its oneness through giving up ego boundaries. It is impossible to see the unity of the universe as long as one sees oneself as an object separate from the rest of the universe. Hindus and Buddhists frequently hold that the infant without ego boundaries knows reality, while adults do not. Some suggest that to know the oneness of reality, we must make ourselves like infants. This can be a dangerously tempting doctrine for adolescents, afraid to assume adult responsibilities. "I can give up trying to be an adult," such a person may think, "and become a saint." Schizophrenia, rather than sainthood, is achieved this way. We must possess or achieve something before we can give it up and still maintain our competence and viability. The infant without ego boundaries may be in closer touch with ultimate reality than its parents, but it is incapable of surviving without its parents, and incapable of communicating its wisdom. The path to sainthood goes through adulthood. There are no shortcuts. Ego boundaries must be hardened before they can be softened. An identity must be established before it can be transcended. One must find oneself before one can lose it. Falling in love, sexual intercourse, or the use of psychoactive drugs may provide a glimpse of nirvana, but not nirvana itself. Lasting enlightenment, true spiritual growth, can be achieved only through the persistent exercise of real love. And yet, falling in love leads us to make commitments from which real love may begin. It gives us a foretaste, and therefore an incentive for, the more lasting mystical ecstasy that is the fruit of a lifetime of love. Therefore, while falling in love is not itself love, it is a part of the great and mysterious scheme of love. The second most common misconception about love is the idea that dependency is love. Its effect is seen dramatically in an individual who attempts or threatens suicide, or becomes incapacitatingly depressed after a rejection or separation from a spouse or lover. Such a person says, "I cannot live without this person. I love him or her so much." I respond, "You are mistaken. You do not love this person. What you describe is parasitism, not love. When you require another individual for your survival, you are a parasite. There is no choice, no freedom in your relationship. Love is the free exercise of choice. Two people love each other only when they are quite capable of living without each other, but choose to live with each other. I define dependency as the inability to experience wholeness or function adequately without being actively cared for by another. Dependency in physically healthy adults is pathological, a manifestation of a mental illness or defect. It is not, however, the same as dependency needs or feelings. We all have the desire to be nurtured by persons stronger than us, who have our interests at heart. No matter how strong and responsible we are, if we look clearly into ourselves, we will find the wish to be taken care of, to have satisfying mother and father figures. But for most of us, these feelings do not rule our lives. When they do, we suffer from a passive-dependent personality disorder, perhaps the most common psychiatric disorder. Passive-dependent people are so busy seeking to be loved that they have no energy left to love. Like starving people, they scrounge wherever they can for food and have no food of their own to give others. They have an inner emptiness, a bottomless pit which can never be filled. They always feel, a part of me is missing. They tolerate loneliness poorly, have no real sense of identity, and define themselves solely by their relationships. A 30-year-old punch press operator, extremely depressed, came to see me 3 days after his wife had left him, taking their 2 children with her. Trembling with anxiety, he was seriously contemplating suicide. "I can't live without my family," he said, weeping. "I love them so." "I'm puzzled," I said to him. "You've told me that your wife's complaints were valid, that you never did anything for her, that you weren't interested in her sexually or emotionally, that you wouldn't even talk to the children for months on end. You have no relationship with your family. So why are you so depressed over the loss of a relationship that never existed?" "I am nothing without my wife and children," he replied. "I don't know who I am." Because he was so seriously depressed, I made an appointment to see him 2 days later, expecting little improvement. But he bounced into the office grinning cheerfully and announced, "Everything's okay now. I met a girl last night at my bar. She said she really likes me. I feel like I'm human once more. I guess I don't have to see you again." Rapid changeability is characteristic of passive-dependent individuals. It is as if it doesn't matter whom they're dependent on as long as there is someone. It doesn't matter what their identity is as long as there is someone to give it to them. Consequently, their relationships, though intense, are shallow. Because of their hunger, passive-dependent people will brook no delay in gratifying their need for others. A beautiful, brilliant young woman had a series of sexual relationships with men beneath her in intelligence and capability. She went from one loser to the next, unable to wait long enough to seek out a man suited to her. Within 24 hours after the end of a relationship, she would pick up some man in a bar and come to her next therapy session singing his praises. "I know he's unemployed and drinks too much, but he's very talented, and he really cares for me. I know this relationship will work." But it never did work. She would cling to the man, seeking to be with him constantly. "I love you so much I cannot bear to be separated," she would tell him. Soon he would feel stifled and trapped. A violent blow-up would occur, the relationship would be terminated, and the cycle would begin again. Passive-dependent individuals are concerned with what others can do for them, to the exclusion of what they themselves can do. Once, working with a group of 5 single patients, all passive dependents, I asked them what life situations they wanted to be in 5 years hence. One way or another, each replied, I want to be married to someone who really cares for me. No one mentioned holding a challenging job, creating a work of art, making a contribution to the community, loving, or even having children. In their daydreams, they envisioned only an effortless, passive state of receiving care. I told them, if being loved is your goal, you will fail to achieve it. The only way to be sure of being loved is to be worthy of love. And you cannot be worthy of love when your primary goal is to be passively loved. When passive-dependent people do things for others, their motive is to cement the attachment of others so as to assure their own care. When the possibility of care is not directly involved, they have great difficulty doing things, like buying a house, separating from their parents, or finding a job. For passive-dependent people, the loss of the other is such a frightening prospect that they cannot tolerate any process which would increase the freedom of the other. In the name of what they call love, they diminish their own and the other's freedom and stature. An example of this is the wife who at some point after marriage develops a phobia about driving and stops. The effect of this phobia in rural and suburban areas is to chain her husband to her by her helplessness. Now he must do all the shopping or chauffeur her on all shopping expeditions. Because this behavior usually gratifies the dependency needs of both spouses, it is almost never seen as sick or even as a problem. She is secure in the knowledge that he will not have an affair and leave her because he is so busy after work taking her shopping and driving the children around. He is secure in the knowledge that she will not have an affair and leave him because she does not have the mobility to meet people when he is away from her. In passive-dependent marriages, security is purchased at the price of freedom, and the relationship retards or destroys the growth of the partners. A good marriage can exist only between two strong and independent people. Passive dependency has its genesis in lack of love. The feeling of emptiness is the direct result of parental failure to fulfill a child's needs for affection and care. Children who are loved and cared for with relative consistency enter adulthood with a deep-seated feeling that they are lovable and valuable, and therefore will be loved and cared for as long as they remain true to themselves. Children growing up where love and care are lacking or inconsistent enter adulthood with a feeling of, I don't have enough, a sense that the world is unpredictable and ungiving, as well as a doubt that they are lovable and valuable. No wonder, then, that they scramble for love and cling to it with a desperation that leads them to manipulative behavior, destroying the very relationships they seek to preserve. Since love and discipline go hand in hand, unloving parents lack discipline and fail to provide their children with self-discipline. Passive-dependent people, therefore, lack self-discipline. They are unwilling or unable to delay gratification of their hunger for attention. In their desperation to form and preserve attachments, they throw honesty to the winds. They cling to outworn relationships when they should give them up. Most important, they lack a sense of responsibility for themselves. They passively look to others, frequently even their own children, for happiness and fulfillment. And therefore, when they are not happy or fulfilled, they feel that others are responsible. Consequently, they are endlessly angry because they endlessly feel let down by others. I have a colleague who tells people, you would be better off being dependent on heroin than on another person. As long as you have a supply, heroin will never let you down. But if you expect another person to make you happy, you'll be endlessly disappointed. In fact, many passive-dependent people depend on drugs and alcohol. Theirs is the addictive personality, When people are not available to be consumed, they often turn to the bottle or the needle or the pill. To sum up, dependency may appear to be love because it causes people to fiercely attach themselves to one another. But in actuality, it is a form of anti-love. It has its genesis in a parental failure to love, and it perpetuates the failure. It seeks to receive rather than to give. It nourishes infantilism rather than growth. It works to trap and constrict rather than to liberate. It destroys rather than builds relationships, and destroys rather than builds people. All life represents a risk. But of all risks, the greatest is the risk of growing up. It is a leap many people never take. Though they may outwardly appear adult, perhaps the majority of grown-ups have never truly separated from their parents and the power their parents have over them. Growing up usually occurs gradually, with multiple little leaps into the unknown. In even the healthiest of children, you will see not only an eagerness to risk new activities, but also a clinging to the familiar, to dependency. You can find this same ambivalence in an adult, in yourself. Many adults never take the necessary leaps into the unknown, and consequently never really grow up. They remain psychological children, living by their parents' values, never having dared to take their destiny into their own hands. Great leaps are most commonly made during adolescence, but they can come at any age. A 35-year-old mother of three, married to a controlling, chauvinistic husband, painfully comes to realize that her dependency is a living death. She divorces him and risks an unknown future, alone with her children, but free to be her own person. Depressed following a heart attack, a 52-year-old businessman looks back on a life of frantic ambition and finds that he has worked himself almost to death to win approval from a domineering, critical mother. Risking her disapproval for the first time and braving the ire of his high-living wife and children, he moves to the country and opens a shop where he restores antique furniture. Such leaps require supreme courage, yet they are not infrequent results of psychotherapy, not because therapy diminishes risk, but because it teaches courage. But what has growing up to do with love? All major changes are acts of self-love. It is because the housewife had regard for herself that she refused to tolerate a marriage that repressed her personality. It is because the businessman cared for himself that he was no longer willing to nearly kill himself in order to meet his mother's expectations. Love for oneself provides the motive and the courage to risk major changes. Only when one has taken the leap into the unknown of psychological independence and unique individuality can one be free to proceed along paths of spiritual growth, free to manifest love in its greatest dimensions. The highest forms of love are totally free choices and not acts of conformity. Commitment is the bedrock of any genuinely loving relationship. Shallow commitments may grow deep with time. If not, the relationship will likely crumble or be chronically frail. Frequently, we are not aware of the immense risk involved in deep commitment. Falling in love blinds the participants to the riskiness of marriage. I was reasonably calm until the moment my wife joined me before the altar. Then my whole body began to tremble, and I can remember almost nothing of the ceremony or the reception. It is commitment which makes possible the transition from falling in love to genuine love. and it is commitment which transforms us from biological into psychological parents. Commitment is inherent in any genuinely loving relationship. Anyone who is truly concerned for the spiritual growth of another knows that such growth can be fostered only through constancy. Children cannot grow into psychological maturity in an atmosphere of unpredictability, haunted by the specter of abandonment. Couples cannot resolve the universal issues of marriage, dependency and independency, dominance and submission, freedom and fidelity, without the security of knowing that the struggle will not destroy the relationship. Issues of commitment are crucial in psychotherapy. Character-disordered individuals tend to form shallow commitments, and when their disorders are severe, they seem to lack the capacity for any commitment at all. They do not understand what commitment is all about because their parents failed to commit to them as children. The parents of neurotics, on the other hand, were sufficiently committed for the child to form a commitment in return. However, a later cessation of parental love through death, abandonment, or rejection makes the child's unrequited commitment an experience of intolerable pain. New commitments are naturally dreaded. Such injuries can be healed only if the person can have a more satisfying experience with commitment at a later date. For this reason, commitment is the cornerstone of the psychotherapeutic relationship. For basic healing to take place, the psychotherapist must bring to the relationship with a patient the same degree of commitment that genuinely loving parents bring to their children. If the therapist's commitment is sufficient, the patient will usually respond sooner or later with a developing commitment to the therapist and to therapy. The point at which the patient begins to demonstrate this commitment is the turning point of therapy. A wonderful moment when the patient assumes the risk of commitment to getting well. The risk of commitment to therapy is not only the risk of commitment itself, but also the risk of self-confrontation and change. It is far from easy to change one's map of reality, yet changed it must be if one is to lead a life of love involving frequent extensions of oneself. On one's journey of spiritual growth, one must often take new and unfamiliar actions in consonance with one's new worldview. Behaving differently than one has behaved before may represent an extraordinary personal risk. The passive young man for the first time asks a girl for a date. The person who has never trusted anyone lies down for the first time on the analyst's couch, allowing the analyst to be hidden from view. The previously dependent housewife announces to her controlling husband that she is obtaining a job. The emotionally distant, seemingly self-sufficient strong man first allows himself to weep in public. Such actions involve a risk that is frequently more frightening than that of a soldier entering battle. The successful psychotherapist must have the same courage and commitment as the patient. The therapist must also risk change. In every successful case, I have had to lay myself on the line. There is not one successful case that did not result in some meaningful, often radical change in my own attitudes. It has to be this way. It is impossible to truly understand another without making room for that person within yourself, without extending and therefore changing the self. What courage and commitment can accomplish in psychotherapy, they can also accomplish in parenting. The same bracketing and extension of ourselves is involved in listening to our children. To respond to their healthy needs, we must change ourselves. Only when we are willing to suffer change can we become the parents our children need us to be. And since children are constantly growing and changing, we are constantly obliged to change and grow with them. The suffering and changing involved in good parenting are not self-sacrifice or martyrdom. Parents have more to gain than their children. Parents who are unwilling to risk the suffering of learning from their children are choosing a path of senility. Their children in the world will soon leave them far behind. Learning from their children is the best opportunity most people have to assure a meaningful old age. Sadly, most do not take this opportunity. The principal form that the work of love takes is attention. When we love another, we give him or her our attention. We attend to that person's growth. When we love ourselves, we attend to our own growth. We set aside our preoccupations and shift our consciousness. Attention is an act of will, of work against the inertia of our own minds. By far the most important way we can exercise attention is by listening, but most of us listen very poorly. Listening well is an exercise of attention, and by necessity, hard work. Not long ago, I attended a lecture by a famous man on the relationship between psychology and religion. I sensed love in the tremendous effort he was exerting to communicate abstract concepts. I therefore listened with all the intentness of which I was capable. Throughout the hour and a half he talked, sweat was dripping down my face in the air-conditioned auditorium. By the time he finished, I had a throbbing headache and I felt exhausted. Although I had understood no more than 50% of what he had said, I was amazed by his many brilliant insights. But the audience found him hard to follow. One woman proclaimed nods of agreement. He really didn't tell us anything. I was able to hear much of what he said because I was willing to do the work of listening, willing because I deeply wanted to enhance my own spiritual growth. My listening was an act of love. I loved the speaker because I perceived his great value, and I loved myself because I was willing to work for my growth. Since he was the giver and I the receiver, my love was primarily motivated by what I could get and not what I could give. Yet it is possible that he could sense within his audience the intensity of my attention, and he may have been thereby rewarded. Love is a two-way street. The receiver gives, and the giver receives. Our most common opportunity to listen in the giver role comes in listening to children. How we listen depends upon the age of the child. A 6-year-old, given the chance, will talk almost incessantly. How can parents deal with this never-ending chatter? There are families in which the dictum, "children should be seen and not heard," applies 24 hours a day. A second way is to permit the chatter, but not listen to it. A third way is to pretend to listen, occasionally making "mm-hmm" or "that's nice" noises. A fourth way is to listen selectively, to prick up your ears if the child seems to be saying something significant. The fifth and final way is to give complete attention, weighing each word and understanding each sentence. What is required is a balance of all 5 ways. At times it is necessary to tell children to shut up. At other times, 6-year-olds will chatter for the pure joy of chattering, and there is nothing to be served by giving them attention. There are still other times when a child's need for closeness can be adequately met by pretend listening. And because children often like to drift in and out of communication, they will understand selective listening. So it is only during a small proportion of their total talking time that 6-year-old children need or even desire total listening. Yet when total listening is appropriate, many parents are unwilling or unable to expend the energy required. True listening requires tremendous effort. A parent who truly wants to listen to a child must put aside everything else. The time of true listening must be devoted solely to the child. What's more, great effort is required for total concentration on the words of a 6-year-old child. Rushes of words interspersed with pauses and repetitions make such concentration difficult. Then, too, the child will usually be talking of matters that have no inherent interest for the adult. In short, truly listening to a child of this age is a labor of love. Without love, it couldn't be done. Why exert all this effort? Your willingness to do so is the best evidence of esteem you can give your child. And the only way to teach your children that they are valuable is to value them. The more children feel valuable, the more they will say things of value. The more you listen, the more you will realize that your child is an extraordinary individual. And the more extraordinary you realize your child to be, the more you will listen and learn. Finally, the more you know about your children, the more you will be able to teach them. The more appropriate will be your teaching, and the more eager your children will be to learn. And the more they learn, the more extraordinary they will become. Such is the reciprocity of love, a creative cycle of evolution and growth. Value creates value, love begets love. Giving full attention to another requires the use of a discipline called bracketing. Bracketing is the temporary setting aside of one's own prejudices and desires so as to experience the speaker's world from the inside. This unification of speaker and listener involves an extension and enlargement of the self and always brings new knowledge. True listening involves a total acceptance of the other. Sensing this acceptance, the speaker will feel less vulnerable and more inclined to open up. Speaker and listener appreciate each other more and more, and the duet dance of love is begun. The energy required for focusing total attention is so great that it can be accomplished only by love, by the will to extend oneself for mutual growth. Most of the time we lack this energy. Though we may feel we are listening hard, we listen selectively, wondering how we can achieve certain results or redirect the conversation. Since true listening is love in action, nowhere is it more appropriate than in marriage. Yet most couples never truly listen to each other. When couples come for counseling, they are often surprised, even horrified, when we suggest that they talk to each other by appointment. It seems unromantic and unspontaneous. Yet true listening can occur only when time is set aside and conditions are supportive. Not when people are driving or cooking or tired or easily interrupted or in a hurry. Romantic love is effortless, and couples are frequently reluctant to shoulder the effort and discipline of true love, true listening. But if they do, the results are superbly gratifying. Again and again we hear one spouse say to another with real joy, "We've been married 29 years and I never knew that about you before." When this occurs, we know that growth has begun. Other forms of attention are also necessary, particularly with children. One is game playing. With the infant, patty cake and peekaboo. With the 6-year-old, magic tricks, go fish, or hide and seek. With the 12-year-old, badminton and gin rummy, and so on. Reading to young children is a way of paying attention. So is helping older ones with homework. Some forms of attention are pure service. Sitting on the beach with a 4-year-old or chauffeuring early adolescents. All these forms of attention involve time spent with the child. And the quality of attention is proportional to the intensity of concentration. In these activities, as in play therapy, parents can find countless opportunities to know their children better, to observe whether children are good or bad losers, how they learn, what appeals to them and what doesn't, when they are courageous and when they are timid. Time spent with the child in activity also gives the parents opportunities to teach skills and basic discipline. Keeping one's eye on a 4-year-old at the beach, concentrating on an endless disjointed story told by a 6-year-old, teaching an adolescent how to drive, truly listening to the tale of your spouse's day at the office or laundromat. All these tasks are energy draining, They mean work. Since love is work, the essence of non-love is laziness. The subject of laziness is a hidden theme running throughout everything I have been saying. Let us turn now from the work of love to the courage of love. When we extend ourselves, we do things we are not accustomed to do. We change. Our self becomes new and different. The experience is frightening, but inescapable if we are in fact to change. Courage is taking action in spite of fear, moving out against fear into the unknown. Spiritual growth, and therefore love, always require courage and involve risk. We will now consider the risking of love. If you are a regular churchgoer, you might notice a woman in her late 40s who every Sunday inconspicuously takes a side pew at the back of the church. The moment the service is over, she makes for the door. She lives in a little apartment where the blinds are always drawn, and has a low-ranking job in a large office, where she types her assignments faultlessly and without comment. She has no friends, no TV set, no phone. She almost never receives mail. She had a dog of whom she was very fond, but he died 8 years before. Were you to comment that her life seemed lonely, she would tell you she enjoyed loneliness. This woman's whole life is devoted to avoiding risks, and in this endeavor she has diminished it almost to non-existence. She cathects no living thing. With cathexis there is always the risk of loss or rejection. If you move out to another human being, that person may move away from you. Love anything that lives and it may die. Trust anybody and you may be hurt. Depend on anyone and that one may let you down. The price of cathexis is pain. A person determined not to risk pain must do without children, marriage, sex, ambition, friendship, all that makes life alive and meaningful. Grow in any dimension, and pain as well as joy will be your reward. A full life will be full of pain. Elect life and growth, and you elect change and the prospect of death. The woman described elected a living death without risk or challenge. I have said that the attempt to avoid legitimate suffering lies at the root of all emotional illness. Most people, whether young or old, have a problem facing the reality of death. If we can live with death, then death can become our ally, still fearsome, but a source of wise counsel. With constant awareness of the limit of our time to live and love, we can live life to the fullest. But if we are unwilling to face death, we deprive ourselves of its counsel and cannot live or love with clarity. When we shy away from death, the ever-changing nature of things, we shy away from life. The final and possibly the greatest risk of love is the risk of exercising power with humility. The most common example of this is the act of loving confrontation. When a parent confronts a child with being sneaky, when a husband confronts a wife with her frigidity, when a wife confronts a husband with not spending enough time with her and the children, they are in essence saying, "You are wrong, I am right." People in many roles confront others routinely and casually, shooting from the hip. Most such confrontation, usually made in anger or annoyance, increases confusion and not enlightenment. For the truly loving person, criticism or confrontation does not come easily. To confront one's beloved is to assume a position of moral or intellectual superiority, at least in the matter at hand. Yet genuine love recognizes and respects the unique individuality of the other person. The truly loving person, valuing the uniqueness of the beloved, will be reluctant indeed to assume, "I know better than you what is good for you." But at times, one person does know better what is good for the spiritual growth of the other. And under these circumstances, the wiser of the two does in fact have a loving obligation to confront. The loving person is frequently caught between a loving respect for the beloved's own path in life and a responsibility to exercise loving leadership. The dilemma can be resolved only by painstaking self-scrutiny. Do I really understand my beloved? Could it not be that the path that my beloved is taking is wise and that my perception of it is unwise as the result of my own limited vision? Am I being self-serving in believing that my beloved needs redirection? Objective self-scrutiny is the essence of humility. In the words of a 14th century British monk, "Any man who truly sees and feels himself as he is must surely be meek indeed." There are individuals who have learned to inhibit the tendency to confront with arrogance, but who hide in the moral safety of meekness, never daring to assume power. To fail to confront when confrontation is required for spiritual growth is a passive failure to love that is just as destructive as more active deprivation of caring. If they love their children, parents must confront and criticize them from time to time, and they must allow their children to confront and criticize in return. Similarly, loving spouses must repeatedly confront each other to promote the partner's spiritual growth. No marriage can be judged successful unless the husband and wife are each other's best critics. The same holds true for friendship. There is a traditional concept that friendship should be conflict-free, but superficial, intimacy-avoiding relationships do not deserve the name of friendship. To confront or criticize is a form of exercising leadership or power. The exercise of power is an attempt to influence events. When we confront or criticize someone, we are trying to change that person's life. There are many other, often superior ways to influence events. For example, by suggestion, questioning, parable, reward and punishment, and so on. Loving individuals must concern themselves with the art of exercising power in order to nurture each other's spiritual growth. Loving parents must first examine themselves and their values before deciding that they know what is best for their child. They must also give thought to the child's character and capacities before deciding whether the child will respond favorably to confrontation or praise or increased attention or some other form of influence. To confront someone with something he or she cannot handle will at best be a waste of time and will likely have a destructive effect. If we are to love, we must adjust our communication to the capacities of the one we love. It is clear that exercising power with love requires work. But what's this about the risk involved? The more loving one is, the more humble one is. The more humble, the more one is awed by the potential for arrogance in exercising power. By what authority am I entitled to decide what is best for my child, my spouse, my country, or the human race? Who am I to play God? That's the risk. Whenever we exercise power, we are playing God. Without the self-awareness demanded by love, most of us are blissfully but destructively ignorant of that fact. But those who truly love and work for the wisdom love requires know that to act is to play God. Yet they also know that there is no alternative except inaction and impotence. Love compels us to play God with full consciousness of what we are doing, attempting to fulfill God's will without mistake. We arrive then at a paradox. Only out of the humility of love can humans dare to be God. I have said that the energy for self-discipline derives from love, which is a form of will. It follows, then, that self-discipline is usually love translated into action, and that any genuine lover behaves with self-discipline. And any genuinely loving relationship is a disciplined relationship. If I truly love another, I will behave so as to contribute to his or her spiritual growth. A young bohemian couple with whom I tried to work had a 4-year marriage marked by screaming, dish-throwing, face-clawing quarrels, along with casual infidelity and separations. Shortly after we began our work, they each perceived that therapy would lead toward self-discipline. "But you want to take the passion out of our relationship," they said, and quit therapy. 3 years later, their chaotic marriage and their unproductivity continue unchanged. Uncontrolled feeling is no deeper than disciplined feeling. On the contrary, shallow brooks are noisy, and still waters run deep. We must not assume that someone whose feelings are modulated is not a passionate person. Feelings are properly like slaves, and the art of self-discipline is like the art of slave owning. Feelings provide the energy that accomplishes the task of living. Since they work for us, we should treat our feelings with respect. But if we do not set limits to our feelings and provide them with direction, like the slaves, they will move into the mansion, raid the liquor cabinet, and break the furniture. Soon, we will be the slaves of our slaves, living in chaos. On the other hand, if we are obsessed with fear that our feelings might get out of control, and we routinely beat them into submission, in relatively short order, our slaves will become less productive or turn toward covert rebellion. One night, the slaves will rise up and burn down the mansion, often with the owner inside. Such is the genesis of certain psychoses. The proper management of feelings lies along a balanced middle path, requiring constant judgment and adjustment. Here the owner treats his feelings with respect, nurturing them with good food, shelter, and medical care. Listening, responding, encouraging, yet also organizing and limiting them, deciding between them,